now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. I am aiming to talk today to people who are inclined to believe the representations of the Obama administration and the intelligence community that Russia, quote-unquote, hacked our election in 2016. As you know, I am a deep skeptic on this subject, and today I bring you a conversation with Trent Lipinski. He's a 30-something cybersecurity consultant and internet entrepreneur based here in San Francisco. And he's written exhaustively on Medium about his doubts about these claims, and we're going to air them out in this conversation today. I invite you to share this with people who believe the myths that have been projected. And I'm grateful to people who support my work, skeptics like Cheryl Fleming, Terry Paris, and the indefatigable Faith Peoples. Faith gave her brother-in-law, David, a subscription to the podcast for the holidays. David, welcome to the Peter B. Collins podcast. And if you'd like to become a subscriber, it's easy. Just come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on menu, click on become a subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and in minutes, you'll be all set. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we go in depth with Trent Lipinski on the question of whether Russia hacked the American election in 2016. Our opening music today is from one of my pet bands of the 1980s, the goth act called Sisters of Mercy. And the song is called Mother Russia. Makes reference to the Kremlin, the Russian White House, and other icons there. My guest today is Trent Lipinski. He is a young entrepreneur who knows the internet. He's a cybersecurity consultant, an active blogger, and in full disclosure, he is the son of a friend of mine who I've known since he was a toddler. And I have a lot of respect for Trent. He knows more than I do about the internet and how it all works and some of these issues that have been raised in the alleged Russian hacking effort. Trent, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
You wrote a piece. You've been blogging over at Medium, and people can catch up with your writing at medium.com. And just if you want to do a search for Medium and Trent Lipinski, it's pretty easy to find his blog. And today I want to go into depth on your most recent piece, Evidence of Russian Election Hacking is Inconclusive. But for a little background, you did a post on Medium that you wrote on election night that drew more than 9 million views, and you tell me at least 3 million people, including me, read it all the way to the end. And you provided what I thought was a provocative and stunning analysis of why Trump won. And it's given you, I guess, a bit of notoriety, and you've been getting a lot of flaming reaction from, I guess, Hillary Clinton supporters and others.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, including Will Wheaton. That was an interesting one there.
I just read that today. He smeared you and jumped to a bunch of conclusions. He considers you a rich brat who, floats above the misery that the rest of us live in. And I know you well enough to know that's really not the case, Trent.
Yeah, no, it was a total smear piece against me. He just straight up made up my social status and then literally tried to use his celebrity to shame me It's ironic because, you know, that's exactly the kind of thing that, you know, Democrats and the liberals are always accusing Donald Trump of doing. And yet here they are doing that to a fellow progressive. So, it was just the most bizarre thing out of all of this. And strangely enough, him and I actually worked together at a blog on a site called Suicide Girls like 10 years ago. He probably doesn't remember me, obviously. I used to actually kind of look up to him when I was a kid because, you know, he was on Star Trek and a bunch of other shows and movies that I had watched when I was, you know, younger. Mm-hmm. that was just the most strange thing. I mean, you know, in a way he was almost kind of, you know, he was playing that whole social justice, like, privilege game. And, you know, I understand the intentions of where, you know, that animosity comes from. But at the same time, it's just extremely hypocritical for a rich, white, celebrity actor who's on mainstream television to literally, you know, kind of, you know, accuse me, essentially, of what he's doing himself. It was just, like I said, bizarre.
Well, and the unconscious reactions of many Clinton supporters in the face of skepticism expressed by, say, me. I have seen it play out both in social media and in person. I was at a holiday party, and we were having a great time, and one of my liberal buddies, who was a big Clinton supporter, made a comment about how Russia hacked the election, and I challenged him. I said, wait a minute, there's no proof. I said, that is a bunch of assertions that are built on what I call spook dust. The assertions of leaked reports from intelligence officials. No individual has put their name on any of these allegations. And then we have this kind of group endorsement where the leak from the CIA that went to members of Congress who then leaked it to the Washington Post, and a group of them leaked something similar to the New York Times. They then, you know, cobble together these various reports of the same leaks and say, look, that's proof. Yet when people like me or Robert Perry or Ray McGovern, a really well-known CIA analyst, retired, or when Bill Binney, the former technical director of the NSA, who I've interviewed twice about this over the last few months, when they say, look, if it was a hack, the NSA would be able to prove it. And yet we've seen zero proof. Just more and more powerful assertions, and I see many people who swallow this propaganda and then label a skeptic like me as a Russian sympathizer or you know, somebody who doesn't love America. I mean, it's really spun out of control in a hysterical manner that we haven't seen since the invasion of Iraq, really.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been accused of being a Soviet agent, and, you know, I just want to go on the record saying, you know, I consider myself to be a patriotic American. I have no interest in defending Russia or the intentions of Russia. I'm just looking at the technical facts of this whole scenario. And then also, you know, my understanding of history tells me that, you know, when the CIA is anonymously leaking things to the Washington Post, usually their intention is not what it seems. This goes back to World War II and, you know, post World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. You know, you had in the 1950s, you had McCarthyism, which was straight up accusing people of, you know, being, treasonous and, you know, accusations of, you know, all kinds of things with no evidence, with no proof, with nothing. And, you know, it's all a reaction. Even, you know, Will Wheaton, who attacked me, that was just him reacting to the aftermath of the election, because the fact of the matter is the entire election was a disinformation campaign. What we were seeing on the media, what the media was telling us, everything that happened, the entire campaign was just lies. They were leaving out the truth. They were manipulating the truth. They were just making up fake news stories. It was just this crazy narrative driven, like, random kind of propaganda campaign that was taking place, and it didn't even have a strategy. It was just, they were just reacting to whatever was happening and then trying to spin these crazy narratives. So everyone has been you know, just assaulted, both if you watch anything on television, if you read anything online, if you follow anybody on Facebook, you know, we've all just been in this giant echo chamber of propaganda over the last year.
Trent, let me jump in to amend that a little bit, because one of the things that we've seen since the election is this whole thing, you know, about fake news. And there has been fake news. But as you point out, the disinformation primarily originates with the U.S. government and with the two major political campaigns that were in combat over the last 6 months. And, you know, many Clinton supporters can't acknowledge that David Brock was running a dark money super PAC called Correct the Record. He was paying people to monitor Facebook and to push back on anybody who criticized Hillary, or to find ways to get the message across that Trump is evil and you simply cannot even think about voting for him. And there was an active disinformation campaign from the Trump side, too. I want to make very clear that both were engaged in this. But there are many people who now look back and don't acknowledge what the Clinton campaign was up to and simply want to demonize Trump, align him with Putin and Russia as a way of trying to delegitimize him. And I don't care to legitimize him in any way, but I can't sit still as an honest skeptic on these issues and just watch people swallow the kind of propaganda that George W. Bush said, yeah, my job is to catapult the propaganda. Well, the Democrats have been catapulting piles of bullshit to willing consumers of it, and it's really a sorry sight to see.
I mean, what we're looking at here really is the, you know, we're experiencing the death of freedom of speech. You know, I really want to go back to what you were saying about Correct the Record. It went way beyond Facebook. You know, Correct the Record was directly influencing both Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, pretty much all the major mainstream media sites. Then if you actually look at the evidence from WikiLeaks itself, the media was colluding with the Clinton campaign. So the Clinton campaign had editorial control over articles that were being published. They had control over when interviews were being taken place. They had the ability to kill stories. There was an absolute collusion between the media and the Hillary Clinton campaign. So then you also had your grassroots kind of disinformation campaign coming from the alt-right. So it was basically a counter response to what was happening from Correct the Record. What's interesting about the alt-right is that, you know, there was no indication that this was a super PAC or that this was money being spent necessarily to have, you know, this kind of troll army on the internet. But it was actual people. It was people responding to the disinformation campaign. These were people who got called out. These were people who were being attacked by this disinformation campaign. They were actually getting pushed to the alt-right because they were being called the alt-right when they weren't. you had this amazing thing taking place. And, you know, I was tracking the alt-right and I was watching alt-right news to see how they were reacting and what was happening with all of this. And the more aggressive Correct the Record got, the more active and the more support the alt-right started to gain. So it's then when I started seeing, you know, people lining up at Trump rallies, you know, 14 hours just to get in. And Hillary Clinton could barely even get a couple hundred people or 1,000 people to show up at her events. So there was this total disconnect of the support, because if you looked, if you were a Hillary supporter and you went online, you would see nothing about, you would see nothing, you know, positive about Trump, and you would see only positive things about Hillary and how great the campaign was going and how there was no chance that she could lose.
Right.
And that was all a giant disinformation campaign, you know, and, you know, I got to give credit to John Podesta. I mean, he is a master of propaganda. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we've got to call it what it is. I've never quite seen anything like it, even in the face of leaks, even with his own emails out there. You know, he just did not stop spinning bullshit.
Yeah.
It was the most tactful thing I've seen from, you know, a propagandist. I mean, he would not back down. And he actually was also the one that kind of spearheaded and started this whole Russian thing. This whole Russian thing started back in October. A lot of people seem to forget that this whole thing that's happened post-election actually happened before we even voted.
Well, and Trent, one of the emails from Podesta's account that was released showed that in an exchange with Neera Tanden, president of the Center for American Progress, which Podesta founded, they traded comments about how we could blame stuff on Russia. That was in
Correct.
December of 2015. And the whole idea, you know, gained momentum over the summer. And it was, I think, a convenient foil for the Clinton campaign to create an even bigger boogeyman than the evil Donald Trump. And because, you know, the Putin-Obama relationship had soured over Ukraine and Syria, it was something that was okay with the Obama administration to turn Putin into this Dr. Evil kind of figure. And so as we looked at this, it was clear to many of us that Clinton was vulnerable and could lose. And in fact, I predicted on August 1st in a wager that I made on my podcast with the author Thomas Frank, I bet him $5 that Trump was going to win. And my inference or my analysis wasn't based on the polls, wasn't based on Russia or emails. It was based on the voter suppression tactics that were successfully used by the Republicans to prevent many Democrats from voting for Hillary Clinton. And so I took a lot of heat from liberals and progressives. I lost many subscribers because I offered my honest opinion about these things. So I say that to lay the groundwork for you to take a minute here to explain to my listeners what your election night analysis was about why Trump won. Give us the five key points or so, if you would, Trent.
Yeah, the main key points were WikiLeaks. Those were the actual emails of Hillary Clinton, the DNC, and John Podesta. Those emails revealed that there was media collusion. Those emails revealed that there was super PAC collusion that was potentially illegal. And most importantly, they revealed that Hillary Clinton did, in fact, rig the primary election against Bernie Sanders and essentially stole the nomination. It still boggles my mind that people don't accept that because we have proof. These are, again, the actual emails of Hillary Clinton and John Podesta and the DNC, and they had absolutely zero intention of allowing Bernie Sanders to be nominated as the Democrats' nominee for president, even though he had far more grassroots support than Clinton. He was literally creating a political revolution. He had the millennial vote completely locked down, and it was, and he had no media coverage. The media completely just didn't cover him.
Had appeal to independent voters who had already decided they couldn't vote for Clinton for various reasons. And I'll add one other thing, that he didn't have the 30-year baggage, and he's been in office for 30 years, but he doesn't have the kind of baggage that Hillary Clinton brought to the campaign. And everybody knew that baggage was there. But like the emperor with no clothes, most Democrats just held their noses and went along with the superdelegates and said, yeah, it's a woman, she's entitled, she can't possibly lose to Trump. End of thought. But it certainly was much more complex than that.
I mean, this isn't the first time the DNC has done this. Historically, we could have had Wallace potentially as a as the vice president under FDR, and then he would have became president when FDR passed. Instead, the DNC, pulled some strings, and last minute they pushed Truman through. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, he's dropping an atomic bomb. So, you think the DNC might have learned some lessons from history on not manipulating the people's choice on who to nominate, because you had a literal grassroots candidate who had was filling stadiums. I mean, he was filling 20,000-30,000 plus stadiums. That many people were physically coming out to support Bernie Sanders in the primaries. This was, with no media coverage, with, very little financial backing, he was able to get that kind of support, whereas Hillary Clinton couldn't, even in the actual election itself, could not get that kind of support in person.
Yeah, she had trouble filling a phone booth with supporters.
It was, you know, she ran the most bizarre political campaign I've ever seen. She, you know, she did not visit swing states. I mean, I don't understand that rationale at all. She didn't hold rallies. She wasn't getting, you know, actual support in real life. It was just running these disinformation campaigns online and controlling the narrative in the mainstream media. She thought she could buy the election, essentially.
So, Trent, let's now focus on the evolution of this blame Russia myth, in my opinion. And that is that back on October 7th, we saw Jay Johnson, who runs Homeland Security, and James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, step in front of microphones and issue a statement that was filled with weasel words and wobbly wobbly verbs. And it basically, you know, created the impression that they thought that Russia had hacked, and we'll get into the definition of hack and leak here in just a second, but they asserted that Russia had hacked the DNC and John Podesta, and that they were attempting to influence the outcome of our election. And I immediately reacted to that, saying, well, where's the proof? And when you read the statement, it was consistent with, and we believe, and that, you know, this is what Russia has done in the past. But there wasn't a single present tense accusation, and there wasn't a single shred of truth. And this then moved forward with the machinations of the FBI director, James Comey, who then said that based on a look at Anthony Weiner's laptop, they may need to reopen the Clinton email investigation. That produced a firestorm of outrage from Clinton supporters. Then 2 days before the election, Comey said, never mind, we're not going to reopen the investigation. And I do think, as a separate issue, Comey's intervention in the election going all the way back to July is something that deserves further analysis. But it's not really germane, in my view, to the blame Russia idea. So then we had the statements that have come more recently, again, that add, you know, kind of a volume to the assertions, but we haven't seen any actual evidence. Then the president announced sanctions against Russia on December 29th, and that is the same day that Homeland Security and the FBI released a joint statement. And that's what I want you to help us analyze today. This statement blamed a group called Grizzly Step, with that step as in the Russian steps, for the cyber activity. And let me just say at the get-go that the use of these English words that refer to Russia, like Fancy Bear and the other bears that were the monikers for these hacker groups, right away signals to me that that's a misdirect. Nobody in their right mind, as a, you know, professional hacker or intelligence operative, would use a name like Bald Eagle. and so, you know, so much of this just has alarm bells that go off immediately when you first look at these assertions. So I've said a lot here. Why don't you pick up on any points you want to make going back to October 7th and up through December 29th?
So I immediately question the October 7th statement because, you know, the key point of that statement is that they claimed that Russia was somehow interfering with the election process. So they're making this allegation that Russia potentially had some kind of, you know, they were hacking the election process as if they were hacking, you know, voting machines or something crazy like that. But that's not at all what they're inferring. I mean, the actual statement from the 7th directly implicates both DCLeaks.com and WikiLeaks, as well as Guccifer 2.0. And, you know, they were trying to create this impression that, you know, though the evidence, you know, showed that, you know, they had somehow gotten, you know, these leaks from Russia, and then the Russians were then using that to, you know, interfere or hack the election process, when no such thing took place. So going back to you know, the statement that was just released on December 29th, the Department of Homeland Security and FBI released this, you know, this statement with, you know, malware, you know, the software essentially that, that, you know, is used for hacking purposes. But the actual malware in question is extremely unsophisticated. You know, Julian Assange said it perfectly the other night on his Sean Hannity interview. This is something that a 14-year-old can download and send to anybody. This is publicly available software. To make matters even, you know, more unusual, the software is actually an outdated version. So they're warning, you know, this statement is basically warning the InfoSec community about outdated software that's publicly available that originated from a hacking group in the Ukraine. So again, not necessarily Russian. So then what's even more bizarre is they released, you know, this list of IP addresses. So an IP address is, you know, the address that, you know, computers use to communicate on the internet. The problem is an IP address is not proof of identity. You know, there are tactics that can be used to fake IP addresses. You can reroute IP addresses. You can spoof IP addresses. They're not proof that, you know, the person at this address, you know, is physically at this location and has this identity and is, you know, Trent Lipinski.
And
that's
Trent,
not how they work.
Let me just add, you're more sophisticated than I am, but I know enough to know that there are many useful purposes for generating an IP address that are not nefarious. And for example, I have a piece of software that generates IP addresses so that people can connect up with me over the internet to receive radio programs. And we do it for stability and predictability, not to pretend that I'm actually in Okinawa.
Correct.
And so anybody can misdirect IP addresses with a virtual private network or other tools.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the startups I'm working with right now, you know, we're constantly manipulating IP addresses and, you know, how things work. And we're working within VPNs. And, you know, that's it's standard security practice for a lot of this. It's a good thing to use a VPN to be able to protect, you know, your network. These are not, you know, necessarily, this doesn't, if you use a VPN, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a hacker. But at the same time, you know, in reference to hacking, to assume that a hacker would not use a VPN, and would not cover their tracks and not attempt to mask their identity is just a complete and total fallacy. Any skilled hacker, anybody who, you know, has any experience with anything regarding hacking or cybersecurity knows to protect themselves and knows ways that they can use to mask their identity. So that's what was so strange about what the DHS and the FBI released, is they released a bunch of Tor nodes. So, you know, they released this list of all these IP addresses, and a significant portion of those were Tor nodes. So Tor is an anonymous method of connecting to the internet that was created by the Navy, I believe, back in the 90s.
You're right. Naval research. And still funded by the State Department in part.
Correct. And so it completely anonymizes internet traffic. So basically, they just released evidence that, you know, this supposed hacking group that was possibly behind this was anonymizing their traffic so it can't be traced. So basically, what the DHS and the FBI just released was evidence that the person who potentially hacked the DNC, or that may have been involved in all this, you know, again, the connections to that, the evidence still isn't there. But, you know, they're arguing that, you know, there may be some connection of these IP addresses to this hack, but yet those IPs are completely anonymized. So they're not actually proof that they have the identity or the ability to even prove who the person was that potentially hacked this. So they released evidence that's counterintuitive to what their narrative is. And then, fascinatingly enough, the IPs that weren't Tor nodes came from the United States, the next largest country, you know, the first actually largest country of IP addresses they released resonated from within the U.S., and Russia was the third, followed by the Netherlands.
Yeah.
So you could easily make the argument, based off of their narrative, that the Netherlands hacked the U.S. election process. But the evidence doesn't actually mean any of that. This is all just misdirection. It's all, you know, as Julian Assange said the other night, it's lawyer speak. They're, you know, they're inferring these different conclusions and presenting them as facts when they're not.
Right.
And the technical evidence just simply does not add up.
And I remind people of the clever phrases that were used by Bush and Cheney and Rice and Powell and Rumsfeld in the selling of the war in Iraq back in 2002, 2003. And when you go back and read carefully the way they connected things in rhetoric that were not connected by evidence or reality, they created perceptions and impressions that people embraced. And likewise, 2 years from now, I think when people look back on this whole propaganda episode, they'll see the clues that you and I are talking about now that for some reason they are unable to process at the moment. And Trent, I had promised to remind listeners of the difference between hacking and leaking. And hacking is when a remote operator gains access to something and removes content or data. And leaking is when somebody decides to share information that they have access to. And so the idea that this originated from leaks at the DNC, to me, is much more persuasive than these far-fetched claims of Russian hacking. And you write in your blog post about this FBI DHS document from December 29th. You say it's a highly technical general security guide and once again contains several conclusions presented as facts without evidence or proof. The document fails to identify how the DHS FBI concluded the Russians were behind the cyber activity. The document also fails to provide proof of intrusion, intent, or what evidence they have linking it to the Russians, WikiLeaks, or the impact it had on election results. What evidence they have released oddly seems to indicate they do not know who was responsible. Now, that's the money phrase in this blog post. Trent, let me repeat it. What evidence they have released oddly seems to indicate they do not know who was responsible. Yet they're telling us now that they're 100% confident that it's Russia without providing us with any solid proof. And I'd like you to address the issue that's most commonly raised by people who are sympathetic to the claim, which is, well, hey, man, it's secret. That's why they're not sharing the evidence with us, because it's secret. But Bill Binney told me that the NSA could prove the route of a hacker without compromising sources and methods. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. I mean, that's what's so fascinating about all of this, is that the fact that the NSA has been completely silent. We know from the Snowden leaks, once again, that was a leak, not a hack. He legally had access to those documents and decided to reveal them, which, you know, is potentially what happened here with the DNC. We know from Snowden that the NSA has the capabilities to monitor, ingoing and outgoing traffic for all the major service providers. So if you take John Podesta, for example, he was using Google. So the NSA would absolutely be able to see, you know, who potentially accessed his Google account and see the transmission of data coming in and out of that account. So the fact that the NSA doesn't have that evidence potentially means that those emails were downloaded locally. So that means that somebody had access.
Trent, let me jump in here, because you just raised a point I want to pursue here. Wouldn't Google also have a trail of, you know, who got into Podesta's Gmail account and where
Correct.
That information went?
Correct. So the only way that I know of that someone would, you know, could prevent Google and the NSA from doing this would be to use both a VPN and use Tor on top of it to access the files. Unfortunately, that would be extremely slow. So to be able to download that much data over Tor and to be able to get all the files and do it that way, and then they would still know that someone accessed the system through that VPN and through Tor. So they would still have some evidence that, you know, something took place. And the fact that Google and the NSA and have essentially said nothing potentially indicates that they don't know or they don't have any evidence. So that just, you know, it kind of just, the lack of the NSA's involvement in all of these claims, the fact that they're not on this letter from the DHS and the FBI, the fact that they've been completely silent throughout this entire thing seems to indicate to me that they potentially have a different view of the situation.
And Trent, let me add, because I referenced the selling of the war in Iraq as a propaganda moment, and there are many people who still have great trust in Barack Obama and other members of his administration. And let me just remind you that the Obama administration and Secretary of State John Kerry said flatly that we know that it was Syria that used chemical weapons in the Damascus suburb, and I think it was in the summer of 2013. And that proved to be false. It was one of the rebel groups that had cobbled together a crude gas missile or shell and had managed to detonate it. But the truth has not caught up with that lie. And the I can still hear John Kerry say, he said it 35 times in one news conference, we know that Syria did it. Well, that wasn't true. And, you know, fast forward to the shoot down of MH17 over Ukraine by, we know it was done by a Buk missile launcher that is made by Russia. But Ukraine's military had possession of Buk launchers as well. And John Kerry and Barack Obama flatly said that Russia was responsible for MH17, but they wouldn't provide any of the evidence of our satellite imagery and other surveillance of the area that would have buttressed their claims. Now there is a study that came out of the Netherlands that does point the finger at Russia, but the United States was thundering its, you know, 100% confidence at a time when the public record didn't show any evidence to indicate that at all. And so these are two episodes where I believe the Obama administration engaged in intentional propagandistic behavior, and I would regard the recent actions, you know, trying to blame Russia as consistent with those methods. And I'm intentionally using the weaselly language that they've used to blame Russia.
So the most fascinating thing to all of that, you know, is that incident was in 2013. So in 2012, you know, Obama passed the NDAA, which legalized the use of propaganda against the American people. So he basically gave himself a blank check and his entire administration to lie to the American people. So if you put that into perspective, that means that basically anything that's happened since 2012, you know, his administration and the media has had a blank check to spread propaganda to the American people. So again, this is, you know, it's the same thing we saw with the election. It's the same thing we're seeing right now with the whole Russian hacking narrative. It's the same thing we saw with the fake news narrative. I'm sure we'll continue to see it moving forward. But, you know, this is a repeated thing that's been happening throughout the Obama administration, and it just continues to get worse. You know, my biggest critique of Obama, you know, is that he didn't take the, you know, all the things that, you know, the Bush administration was working on, from their spying programs, their surveillance programs, their propaganda programs. He took everything the Bush administration was doing, and instead of getting rid of it, instead of, you know, keeping his promises of hope and change, he doubled down on everything and made it more efficient.
Well, he normalized it.
Even and legalized it.
Yeah, he normalized it and legalized it. And I keep, whenever I meet a member of Congress, I always just ask them, and some of them I use the strong language. I say, I want my goddamn Fourth Amendment back. And they're floored.
Exactly.
What do you mean, man? What are you talking about? So, Trent, we're speaking here on the 4th of January, and today's New York Times had this piece headlined, Trump appears to side with Assange over intelligence agencies' conclusions. And I'm very uncomfortable being on the same side of this dispute with Donald Trump. But to see the New York Times peddle as a news column this item, which is riddled with opinions and assertions and conclusions, and is intended to trivialize or demean people who have honest skepticism about these claims by basically saying, well, you wouldn't want to believe Julian Assange, would you? So let me quote from you here, from this here. For the Republican Party, Mr. Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, was once purely a villain. He found little sympathy with conservatives after he leaked American military secrets from Iraq, published purloined diplomatic cables that could have gotten American sources killed. They didn't. And sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, fleeing charges of rape. Now, that is a massive smear of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, intended to caricature and cartoonize, his reputation and the work that they've done. And it presents this false choice, because we know that Russia may have, in fact, succeeded in hacking into these places. But the allegation is that Russian hacks were fed to WikiLeaks and produced the election outcome that Putin engineered. And that is what is so far-fetched here. And to see the New York Times using smear tactics to try to, corner Trump on this issue and separate him from the intelligence community after the New York Times itself has been burned repeatedly by leaks from the intelligence community, it is just so absurd that words really fail me, Trent.
I mean, there was a CNN piece this morning where they were talking to an ex CIA member of the intelligence community, and he literally accused Julian Assange of being a pedophile, which is a completely unfounded allegation that I've seen no evidence of. They just seem to be pulling any tactics they can to smear Assange, smear WikiLeaks, smear Trump. This whole Russian narrative, I actually believe, is in fact an attempt to delegitimize the election of Donald Trump, and that is more their primary attention, their intention, than anything else. Because it's the perfect narrative. It delegitimizes WikiLeaks, so it distracts from the content of WikiLeaks, so that we don't hold the Democrats responsible for all their illegal activities. And then it also delegitimizes, Donald Trump. And then at the same time, it potentially creates this, ongoing conflict with Russia that makes, the Democrats look strong in like war hawks and whatever. Now you've got, Obama, he's finally issuing sanctions and he's finally putting on the big boy pants that, conservatives have been asking him to put on for 8 years now, except now he's doing it to smear them and discredit them. It's really fascinating. I mean, the whole thing with WikiLeaks, again, they released the actual true emails. So no matter if Russia did in fact hack the here I'm falling for the, right. Their rhetoric here.
Yeah.
If Russia did in fact hack the DNC and give that information to WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks release the truth. These are not editorialized, emails. These are the actual emails of Hillary Clinton and John Podesta. This is transparency. Transparency is the thing we should be looking for in our government. We should be able to read Congress's emails. I don't see why we shouldn't be able to.
Right.
The fact that they keep everything secret in the first place no longer needs to exist, because we have the technology now to have the transparency to prevent this kind of thing from happening.
Trent, let me just interject here, because for me, the bottom line is that if Obama really believed this bullshit, he would be demanding a new election, because we just forced Haiti to rerun their presidential election again. Okay. And we did it because there were allegations of massive fraud. And so here, not only, let's just treat the Russia scenario as one angle. We have voter suppression. We have evidence from the partial recount in Michigan that 75,000 voters in Detroit chose not to vote for anybody for president, and that's more likely a miscalibrated, possibly intentionally miscalibrated optical scanner or scanners. And we know there were problems with scanners in Michigan on Election Day. So there's a whole body of evidence that could be marshaled to make the case that could have been made to the Electoral College, that could have been made in some sort of a legal challenge brought to the Supreme Court. But the Democrats aren't taking any action to try to correct what they see as an election that was manipulated by a foreign government. They're content to issue sanctions and send the chef at the San Francisco Russian consulate back to Russia, and that's going to fix it. So this to me is the biggest indication that this whole thing is a charade.
Well, there's a counter narrative to all of this. So Julian Assange has stated multiple times that it was not Russia or a Russian actor. And then you had Craig Murray, who is a former ambassador and a WikiLeaks activist, who actually went against Assange and WikiLeaks and came out and said that he personally met the leaker in the United States, I believe outside a university in Washington, D.C., and physically acquired the document. So this is a counter-narrative to what the U.S. government is selling, that it is, in fact, an insider, a leaker. And then you have a DNC data analyst, Seth Rich, who was mysteriously murdered in July. So you literally have you've got a data analyst, someone who had legal access to the DNC, who would have had access to all of these emails, who understood how these files worked, who would have been able to save the files, we're talking about someone, either possibly even above my technical skill level. And they were murdered. Seth Rich, they claim that, it was a robbery, yet there was nothing taken from his person. There was he was still wearing his watch. They didn't take his cell phone. They didn't steal anything. So how did, you've got a plausible explanation for how this all could have came down.
Well, and Trent, again, in a couple of years, when we look back and timeline this, one of my impressions, and I can't prove it with hard facts at this point, but I've been monitoring the corporate media, and this counter-narrative that you just described has only surfaced in recent days because Trump has tweeted about it, and Sean Boy Hannity went to London and got the interview with Assange. Up to that point, the corporate media wasn't even acknowledging Craig Murray's assertions or Julian Assange's claims. And last night on the Public News Hour, Judy Woodruff interviewed John Brennan, the soon-to-be former CIA boss, and she asked him tough questions, including about the Assange claims that the leaks didn't come from Russia. And she asked the tough questions because she knew he wouldn't answer them. He kept saying, well, I can't get ahead of the report that we're going to issue that the public will never see, that other talking heads are going to tell you confirms what we've been saying. And so it's this fascinating circle of bullshit. And it was carefully launched. It has been, really downed hook, line, and sinker by most Americans. And it is just bizarre to, see this taking place and be in the positions that you and I are, fantasy.
Yeah, it's 1950s McCarthyism all over again. I mean, I've been accused of being a Soviet agent on Twitter. That's the most outlandish thing I've ever heard. Some guy started tweeting, I'm 100% certain that, Trent Lipinski is a Russian Soviet agent. I'm like, I've never even been to Russia. I don't know any Russians. Like, I don't speak Russian. Like, completely insane. And then what was worse was that, the next thing I'm being attacked by 5, 10, 15 people. There was this collective, moment where, oh, this guy must be a Soviet agent. Let's attack him. So people who didn't know me, who had no information about anything, just simply jumped on this accusation and started attacking me. And it's the same thing that Will Wheaton did. It's this irrational cognitive dissonance that gets created from these disinformation campaigns. People actually believe these narratives that are being sold by the government because they, if they don't, then they have to accept the reality that they don't know the answers, that there are other possibilities and that they are going to have to critically think on their own. It's this whole herd mentality. And, this is not anything new. I was recently reading Audius Huxley's Revisited of Brave New World. And, he goes into all the things that influenced his book. And he has, chapters on brainwashing and propaganda, and the tactics that he was going through. He was a strong student of history himself, and mm-hmm. He lived through World War II, And, you know, a lot of the tactics that we're seeing right now, these are all tactics that stem from, you know, the Great Depression, that stem from World War II. Some of this propaganda even dates back to World War I. You know, I've also been, you know, studying Edward Bernays and some of the, you know, I mean, he literally wrote a book called Propaganda and basically invented PR. So this whole, you know, this whole culture of propaganda and disinformation and the media, the mainstream media, all of this, you know, all of this stuff has been kind of boiling over for the last 70 years. And we're now at this point, you know, in history where we have the technology to be able to spread these kind of messages instantly. So, but at the same time, you also have technology like Facebook that actually puts you in an echo chamber and actually disconnects you from dissenting opinions.
Yeah.
So you're actually just getting the information that you want so that you don't see anything that makes you feel uncomfortable. But the reality is uncomfortable. You know, that's the world we live in. You know, things happen in reality that, you know, aren't good. And they, this is, you know, that's history. That's this moment. That's the next moment. You know, there's always going to be things that cause discomfort for people. And, you know, but ignoring that, being in denial about it, and, you know, falsely, you know, or just believing in these fake narratives and just, you know, putting blind faith in the government, you know, that, to me, that's unpatriotic. That's somebody who's not studying. That's somebody who's not paying attention. That's somebody who, you know, is just blindly following, you know, a leader who's about to be out of office soon. You know, we're about to go through a major transition here where we're going to see a major shift in power. And, you know, we've got to be on a united front as the American people right now, and especially the Democrats. The Democrats need to unite right now. If they want to have any chance of even being relevant during the Trump presidency, they need to unite. They can't be doing what Will Wheaton's doing and attacking fellow progressives. Like, that doesn't accomplish anything. They can't, you know, be defriending you and unsubscribing from your show. Like, how is that going to help anybody by just going into echo chambers and ignoring reality?
Well, because we've been trained to use our remote control to feed our pleasure receptors and avoid the kind of reality that you referred to. Trent Lipinski, it's great visiting with you. Thank you for your informed, skeptical commentary, your sharp analysis, and your great sense of history. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
There's a millennial who gives me a lot of hope for the future, Trent Lipinski. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you.